Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. And happy PA Week.
Yes, and happy Hispanic Heritage Month, which will be celebrated until the 15th of this month as well.
Yes, and we're excited to review CME articles on PCOS and HOCM, and also discuss this month's articles on a PA doctoral degree curriculum, and an article pertaining to the art of medicine entitled His Song.
But before we jump in, just a quick reminder, after listening to the podcast, go to cme.aapa.org, scroll to the bottom of the page, and take the CME post-test to earn one Category 1 CME.
Thank you, Brandon, for that quick reminder. And lastly, here's our quick disclaimer. This podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, and they do not represent JAPA, the authors, or the editor's opinions, or the publisher. This is not intended as medical advice.
So for the first article that we will be reviewing, it's titled Screening for Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy, and the authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So I was interested in this topic because as a young athlete, I would frequently hear about stories where people had this disease and would suddenly die. However, I never really knew actually what was going on until PA school, and always wondered why I wasn't specifically asked questions about this when I would go to the doctors, or maybe I just didn't remember. As it was known that I had played sports, both football, basketball, lacrosse, baseball, all. Now, thanks to this article, I now know the background and screening process for this disease. And if I ever happen to have the opportunity to screen someone or just to recommend that to a fellow clinician, I will be sure to do so. So we asked why is this topic important? And it is important because hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is the most common inherited cardiomyopathy, and it puts patients at risk for sudden cardiac death. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is an autosomal dominant inherited disease where the size of the left ventricle is enlarged, as well as enlargement of the septum of the heart. And due to these abnormalities, patients become more at risk for dysarrhythmias. There are four common genes that are responsible for HCM, as they include the sarcomere proteins that are found in the myocardium causing these enlargements. They are listed in the article, however, not really prevalent because genetic testing is rare. So we asked, how will the patients present? Many patients are asymptomatic. However, some patients experience shortness of breath, chest pain, fatigue, syncope, and palpitations, all symptoms that are consistent with any other cardiac disease. And Lena, on physical exam, what would you expect to hear on auscultation of the heart? This was one of those quick ones. Yeah, a murmur. Yeah, it's that harsh crescendo, decrescendo systolic murmur. And it's best heard at the apex as well. And this mitral regurg murmur is caused by the left ventricular outflow tract obstruction. And can you tell me what maneuver helps attenuate this murmur?
A Valsalva maneuver?
Exactly. And one may also hear an S4 sound and be able to feel a left ventricular lifter palpation of the chest. And also to assist with the physical exam, one may also order an EKG, which may display P wave changes due to the enlargement of the left atrium, septal Q waves in the inferior and lateral leads, left axis deviation in leads V2 through V4, and you may see inverted T waves and left ventricular hypertrophy as well. The one drawback about easy EKGs is that you may not be able to see these findings until the disease progresses. Other imaging may include an echo, which is actually recommended for the initial evaluation, and a cardiac MRI. The benefit of a cardiac MRI is that it is able to display myocardial edema and better identify patterns of hypertrophy and diastolic wall thickening. It is also effective in assessing fibrotic changes, which have an influence in the overall prognosis of patients with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The recommendations for screening come from the American Heart Association, who also developed a 14-point evaluation, which was noted in the article, and is recommended for all children under the age of 19. And after going through this evaluation, or these like sets of questions, if a patient crosses off more than one point, then the patient should be referred to cardiology for further workup. And to my surprise, the AHA did not recommend EKGs universally, which makes sense universally, but in pertaining to patients with HCM, because they don't recommend it due to the cost burden, but we know from working in the real world, especially in the hospitals, EKGs are typically given out like candy. Anytime you come in, I guess that's probably in the older population, not so much in the pediatric population, but I would actually be curious. I may look that up afterwards, what's the actual cost of an EKG in
they're pretty cheap.
Relation to this. Yeah, that's what I was expecting, but I would want to see what the actual cost is. So we move on to what's the treatment. As with many diseases, lifestyle modifications are the initial treatment. These patients must stay hydrated and have personalized exercise plans coordinated with their physician. It was also noted that the patient should pay attention to the factors that are associated with any other type of cardiac disease, such as lipid levels, low sodium diets, and low carbohydrate diets to help support a healthy heart. It was also noted that the patient should have close follow-up with their dentist every 6 months to help prevent endocarditis secondary to dental infections, as well as close follow-ups with the patient's PCP or cardiologist. For patients who are symptomatic, medical intervention may be needed, again, very similar to other health conditions, such as the use of beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, statins, ACEs, or ARBs. For those with severe symptoms, an ICD may be considered, as well as surgical intervention, with the preferred procedure being a septal myectomy. And lastly, the definitive treatment would be a heart transplant. And a few points I would like to leave you with is that even though this cardiac disease is rare, it can be fatal, and getting a thorough family history may be the difference maker, as this disease has a strong genetic component, especially when looking at first degree relatives. Lastly, be on the lookout for non-sustained VTEC and ventricular premature beats, as these are associated with HCM, and if recognized early, can be the difference maker in saving a life.
This is so important because I feel like especially athletes sometimes, or young male athletes might sometimes be discriminated against as well if they present with chest pain. And sometimes providers may, I don't know, if they don't check their implicit biases, might think the patient's like pain seeking, or, you know, and kind of miss the diagnosis of HOCM. But I'm glad there's more and more awareness about it, so that way providers, we're keeping this on our differential.
For sure. I know just chest pain in the pediatric population is, like you said, just kind of looked over. You typically think, you know, like it's like a cold or flu or something like that. But again, this those 14 points that they had given are quick to go through, probably take no more than 5 minutes. And that's definitely worth training to help save someone's life, just to be a little bit more in-depth, a little bit more focused when going over chest pain with a child.
I agree. I also just wonder what the average age of diagnosis of HOCM is in adolescents. Maybe we'll follow up on that.
Yeah. The average age and the average price of EKG.
Gee, oh my gosh. For our next CME article, we're going to be discussing the diagnosis and treatment of polycystic ovary syndrome in adolescents. This article was written by Jay Leocodia Conlone and Sharon Malcolm, as well as Maureen Monaghan. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. PCOS, also known as polycystic ovarian syndrome, is an endocrine disorder that involves both ovulatory dysfunction and hyperandrogenism. For some quick epidemiology, PCOS is the most common endocrine disorder diagnosed in women and is the leading cause of infertility in women in the U.S. Additionally, PCOS is a major risk factor for metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes. And unfortunately, a late diagnosis is usually made, as symptoms often begin in adolescence, and women do not usually present with further symptoms, usually more so infertility, until adulthood. And this is usually due to the misconception of PCOS symptoms with puberty in adolescence. And still today, there's no clear diagnostic criteria for PCOS in adolescence. But luckily, we have the CME article to help us out in the meantime. But before we move on, I just wanted to quickly mention that the article goes into a brief history behind PCOS, which I found quite interesting. And if you're curious, so you may want to check that out. But for time's sake, let's talk about the pathophysiology of PCOS. Unfortunately, the exact pathophys is unknown. However, androgen excess is what you want to think of. How and why this occurs is again not specifically understood, but suspected multiple factors are at play, including primary ovarian dysfunction, insulin resistance, neuroendocrine hormones, genetics, epigenetics, and the sympathetic nervous system. When talking about the clinical manifestations of PCOS, we want to think of ovarian dysfunction, hyperandrogenism, like we mentioned earlier, as these kind of define the symptoms your patient may present with. And some of these symptoms are irregular menses, which the article has a really awesome chart which helps define this based on your patient's age and how many years post-menarche they are. Amenorrhea, hirsutism, there's a chart in the article that provides further guidelines for this. Moderate to severe acne, excess body weight and obesity, but this can be a little confusing as obesity exacerbates the metabolic complications of PCOS, but it's not actually clearly defined as a symptom of PCOS. But also, PCOS leads to a slower metabolism in patients, which again can also cause obesity. And additionally, insulin resistance can be a clue in the diagnosis of PCOS, as this is, again, a result of an impaired metabolism. And lastly, the appearance of multiple cysts on the ovaries on transvaginal ultrasound. For a diagnosis of PCOS in adolescents, the article refers us to the ICPE 2017 consensus statement. However, some diagnostic labs you should order to rule out any additional conditions with similar presentations to PCOS are a beta-HCG to rule out pregnancy, a TSH to rule out thyroid dysfunction, a 17-OH progesterone level to rule out congenital adrenal hyperplasia, a total testosterone and free testosterone, which could be elevated in PCOS, FSH, LH, and estradiol to rule out premature ovarian failure, which you would probably maybe suspect in a patient that presents with amenorrhea, prolactin to rule out hyperprolactinemia. Also, you want to grab labs to rule out an androgen-secreting tumor. And lastly, you want to grab metabolic testing, which should include a fasting blood glucose, A1C, and a lipid panel. And additionally, you may want to do a transvaginal ultrasound. However, this is not recommended for a diagnosis of PCOS and should not be done in women who are less than 8 years post-menarche. The treatment for PCOS involves two major things, lifestyle modification and pharmacological management. And additionally, symptom relief and management should be addressed when talking to your patient. In brief, lifestyle modification should include implementing a healthy diet, exercise, a healthy discussion on family planning, as not all patients with PCOS have infertility and can still become pregnant with intermittent ovulatory cycles, which is really important to kind of outline for your adolescent patients as well, so they don't have a misconception that they just can't get pregnant and may have unprotected sex, and also to talk about the importance of not having unprotected sex. And additionally, CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy may be important for adolescents struggling with obesity or in general to help cope with the diagnosis of PCOS. Pharmacological management includes metformin, which is the most common medication used for insulin resistance in patients with PCOS, but is also shown to promote ovulation in patients with infertility. Oral contraceptives with both estrogen and progesterone to help regulate irregular menses and improve symptoms of hyperandrogenism. However, you should always assess any contraindications for your patient. And lastly, spironolactone can also be helpful for symptoms of hyperandrogenism. However, caution is warranted when prescribing this to adolescents, and more specifically, which I find very interesting, the guidelines recommend a 6-month trial of oral contraceptives plus laser hair removal or any other cosmetic procedure for hair removal first before using an anti-androgen for hirsutism. Brandon, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, PCOS is, I always forget that. There was a patient who came in and I was just going to their chart. I was like, why were they on metformin? And yeah. When I went in there and I asked her, that's for like my PCOS. That was like one of the first thing that has came to my mind, just the management of it. But I was also just thinking of how tough it is for women. There's just like a lot of factors that come into like infertility, and just how I think I know like a couple of women that initially just put the burden on themselves. Yeah. And it's a very tough, I guess, journey to go through, like trying to conceive. When I come across like these articles, it's just, I guess, just makes me very appreciative of just life and how precious it is, and how lucky couples are to be able to conceive, to have a baby, and for them to be healthy, because women go through a lot that is not in their control in regards of being able to conceive.
Yeah. And I like that. I appreciate that the author is kind of focused on diagnosing this in adolescence, so that way, too, women are a little bit more prepared or have more time to kind of figure out, you know, if they do want to have a child, they can kind of have more time to do the family planning portion and mm-hmm. gather more information, education for themselves. I also was caught off guard. I remember on my OB-GYN rotation, there was a couple that they were trying to conceive, and one of the ladies in the partnership, she had PCOS, and she was not obese, which the article talks about. Not all women with PCOS suffer from obesity, and the provider wanted to put her on metformin. I was like, she's not obese. I'm like pretty sure she doesn't have, you know, any insulin resistance or, you know, diabetes right away. And I thought that was kind of drastic, but I kind of, you know, glad the article focused on how metformin can also help promote ovulation for patients. And I also found it quite interesting, the last point, that before using like spironolactone or any anti-androgen for hirsutism, they recommend a cosmetic procedure first. And I'm just curious, like from an insurance standpoint, is that something that's covered or like reasonable, especially for patients with like an underserved health.
There'd be a lot of prior off.
Yeah. My patient needs laser hair removal. I don't care what you say. It's important to their overall well-being.
It really affects someone. I know how it affects men, just the idea of hair loss.
Yeah.
I have a couple of friends that are approaching that stage in their life where they're balding. And we all like joke about it, but it does have a lot of effect on people's confidence and how they maneuver in society. And I could imagine the same thing for a woman, just like the standards that we place on women to be clean shaven hair and just to have it like on your chin or your face, like wherever the hair grows. It is tough. I don't even think we have to think about it. Insurance, I would put a lot of money on that insurance isn't covering.
I know. It's a shame, though, because it's important for your patient. You know, we talk about seeing your whole patient, like, that's something that's super important. That's something that is something important to your patient. You know, it's something worth fighting for.
For sure. So the next article that I will be reviewing is under The Art of Medicine, and it's titled His Song. The author has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So I like this article. It was a good reminder of just like stepping back and understanding, I guess, the emotional aspect that comes into medicine and the relationships and the connections that can be made during your encounters with your patient. And just a brief overview, this guy, the author, he's a pediatrician. Works in pediatrics, and he just coming, it seemed like the child had a viral like URI, just coughing, gave him a breathing treatment, and it comes out later in the patient encounter that the there was a song that helped soothe the baby throughout the encounter, and then the mom revealed that that was a song that was played at the child's grandmother's service, and just how like little things like that can, it definitely stuck with the author. Like he said, how that song like put him at ease later on in the day. I think it stated, the instrumental score transports me to another realm, a place of peace. I let the song play through the end. It lasts 8 minutes, time enough to cover a breathing treatment and time enough to settle a soul. And there's just so much. I just want to take, like, I guess this time, or like this article just reminded me just to take the opportunity of actually, like, feeling what's going on with your patients, and the whole, like we just talked about, the whole scope of things, especially, I guess, in the pediatric realm, like with the parents as well, and how it can be just the little things that mean the most to a patient or during a patient encounter, just being genuine on asking, like, how's someone's day going, just showing interest or that you actually care about their well-being and their family's well-being. And just, it's like those moments is kind of like why I, like, chose to get into medicine. Just being able to connect with people and to, I guess, share those moments that bring joy between both, I guess, the clinician and the patient. Or just like little memories or periods of nostalgia that bring positive thoughts and, I guess, like happiness or good memories. I think about, probably was in the peak last year when, like, COVID was real, like, where every patient that came to the hospital was a COVID patient. And I seen this mom, it just reminded me of my mom. She was, like, in her 50s, and then she was battling breast cancer. She had just got over ovarian cancer, and it was, like, a prognosis that the cancer had become metastatic and then that she wasn't going to make it anymore. And she was just in the room with her two daughters, and they were about my age. And just to see, like, the faith that they had that everything was going to be okay, was just like a touching moment. And but it's also tough, like, I was just seeing them tearing up. They just were telling me that they, it sucks seeing their mom like this, but that their faith in God, they were sure that she was going to pull through this, which was just a touching moment. I just, like, spent time with them, just moments of silence. Sometimes, like, silence is, like, the best conversation, and just showing people, like, you don't always have to say something. Just being there, and just, like, your body language can show a lot. So this article just was a reminder for me, and I guess everyone should use this as a reminder to remember, like, why you got into medicine. I feel like 99% of us somewhere in our personal statement said we wanted to help people, and I think that embodies both all aspects of physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. All those aspects are why we go into these patients' rooms and try to help them. A majority, it's usually just the physical aspect that we have the time to address, but always use the opportunity to help someone emotionally, spiritually, whatever you feel comfortable with. Just remember that we are dealing with humans, and we're humans ourselves, and we have feelings, and let's use those feelings to help make someone else's day better.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think sometimes, you know, even, like, talk to students and emphasize, you know, listening to your whole patient, treating your whole patient. And I think sometimes in medicine, mm-hmm. we get so focused on, like, we want to heal our patients physically and sometimes even emotionally. But in this case, you know, from a medical standpoint, some might view, you know, the patient you were talking about maybe physically wasn't healed. But then sometimes providers, you put the pressure, at least, like, I want to at least heal the family. And, like, but sometimes that's not your job. Sometimes your job is just to allow space for them to heal in their own way and to feel out their emotions, or not to rush that process, and allow them to feel the emotions that are expected to be felt in such a situation or in vulnerable situations. And I always remind students that someone seeing us and seeing a provider is a vulnerable experience in itself, and so you can't ignore that, mm-hmm. and try to dismiss that, even though it's sometimes more uncomfortable. But sometimes you just have to let it be uncomfortable.
For sure.
And for our last article, we're going to be reviewing an original research article titled Curriculum Essentials of an Entry-Level PA Doctoral Degree by Gerald Kayingo, Karen Gourds, Hyun Jin Ju, Shani Fleming, Violet Kulu, and James Colley. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. I hope I said everyone's name correctly. If not, I apologize. In brief, this article was basically to kind of see what components of an entry-level PA doctoral degree should include, and kind of how this would maybe promote or hinder the PA profession as a whole. Some of the quantitative data that they gathered before I get further into what the article revealed, most of the respondents were white females, which is consistent with the PA profession as a whole. About 68% of the respondents to the survey for the data for this research, 70% were female, 82% were white. However, surprisingly, 6% were black, which is the second highest, and then 6.4% were Asian. And the length of practice as a PA, less than 5 years. Most respondents were less than 5 years, but it was pretty even across the board. 23% 5 to 10 years practicing as a PA, and then 26.7% practicing for 11 to 25 years as a PA. But overall, components that most respondents agree a entry-level doctoral PA program should include: expanding on clinical skills, writing research methods, ethics, also additional curricular content and leadership, education, and a deeper breadth of didactic instruction overall. And they think that this would better prepare students overall and the PA profession in research skills. And I think really interesting was academic teaching skills as well. But what I found interesting, that their data showed that about half of respondents felt that the current number of credits, depth, and breadth of PA educational programs are sufficient for a doctoral degree, and that it would also help promote the PA profession, as opposed to another study that they kind of mentioned in the article that found 60% of surveyed respondents agreed that an entry-level doctoral degree would actually cause more harm than good. And majority, 82% of that particular research article that they were mentioning, strongly agreed that it should not be required. So I guess I'm wondering if they're hinting at if a doctoral degree should be needed to become a PA, which, considering the history of the PA profession, it was just a bachelor's degree was just needed, and now a master's degree is needed. I don't know. I know we've talked about previously in podcasts also keeping ourselves, I don't want to say competitive, but for, gaining or improving our relationship between physicians and resident physicians, and, kind of making our mark in the medical community. But I think, I know there's this natural push to want us to know more and more, and I can understand that. Again, to keep us, again, I don't want to use the word competitive, but to keep the interest of utilizing PAs there. But I think if we keep increasing the requirements, then at some point I'm going to be like, well, what's the difference between a PA with a doctoral degree, a doctor, versus like a medical doctor? And so I think we have to remember too the whole history behind the PA profession, given that this is recorded during PA week, is that, it started out in the Navy. We needed more. There was a physician shortage. And I think, and there still is. And I think that's when PAs and nurse practitioners, basically APCs, where we come into play. I think a doctoral degree is, I think it should be available to PAs, but I wouldn't say necessarily required to become a PA, because I think, we have several other resources to help fill in our knowledge, such as like residencies. You can always start in primary care and then to get a good breadth of knowledge and then specialize if you see fit. I know it can sometimes be frustrating, especially as a new grad, because you feel like you know nothing. And again, you're, especially if you work in a teaching institution and you're working with residents and so many other different providers, it can kind of be intimidating. You're like, do I know enough? But I think we also have to remember the purpose of why the PA profession started out and why we're here. But I think it's always a great option to have to further your education, or if you want to learn more, or you want to go into another specialty or go into an academics.
Yeah, I would just be curious as to what would you be learning in, I guess, the extra 2 years, because at that point, why, what is the skill set that you're going to have that's different than an MD if you're both doing 4 years. And we know that the PA curriculum is based on a med school curriculum. So I would be curious. I'm a very big advocate that kind of that, like, I tell people that I see a lot of PAs try to get a lot of responsibilities as MDs, and I said, like, if that's what you wanted to do, if that's what you felt that your true calling was in the professional sense, then you should have went to med school. And just knowing your role, like, patients say, how do you feel that that shit? No, because this is a real conversation that needs to be had, because it's, I guess I'm maybe biased. I have a group of maybe, what is it, like 6 or 7 friends. They're all in either their fourth year of med school or residency right now. And I see that the work, the time, the effort that they have to put in. We had to bust our butts in PA school, but we didn't have to do residency. We didn't have to do more than the 2 years. Yeah, 27 months and we're done. I kind of feel like sometimes people neglect or fail to recognize the time and effort it takes to actually be an attending. And if it's like, if you want attending responsibilities, you have to put the work in to be an attending. And I tell people that PAs were made, like, we work on a team with a physician. We have a lot of the same responsibilities, but they're always there as a support force, and they typically have a little bit more in-depth knowledge on disease processes and so forth. The analogy, when I was speaking to people who know sports, I'd say that physician is more like, if we're on a football team, I would say the PA is like, when I go into the room, I tell them, like, hey, I'm the quarterback. This is my field. I have everything under control. But in the background, there's a doc who has the answers. If I have a question, if I want to change a play or something, I can run it by them. And at the end of the day, ultimately, the head coach has the final call on decisions, but things are delegated to me, and I have the autonomy in a sense to make decisions on my own, but at the end of the day, you have to listen to your head coach. So that does, the way I've been able to explain what a PA is, to those who know sports, it's very easy. But to those who
quarterback don't, had all that autonomy.
I'm still trying to think of an analogy to help explain it to other people, because you have to change, you have to, like, use different examples, different analogies with different people, because sometimes, you know, everyone goes back to the same thing. So are you a doctor or are you a nurse? And when you say neither, they just look at you crazy. I like to say I'm your provider or I'm your clinician for the day.
I think too, this would also be kind of requiring a doctoral degree to become a PA. You know, not only, again, does it exacerbate, you know, the provider shortage, but also I'm thinking of, you know, students who come from disadvantaged backgrounds who can't afford to be, you know, in school for that length of time to become what they want to do. And again, thinking about, you know, those who come from underserved communities and backgrounds who want to serve those, and even rural communities as well. So I think it might be interesting maybe to make it a requirement, like, after so many years as a PA, which maybe some of our listeners are like, no, don't do that.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Because when people say, oh, you're not going back to school, I said, absolutely not. Like, I'm done with school. I did enough school, and I'm happy with the decision that I made. I think what needs to happen is that people, a lot of people don't thoroughly research.
Yeah, I was gonna say that you got to know who you are too.
Yeah, you have to know who you are, and what you want out of medicine. And even, like I said, my friends in med school, they a couple of them are kind of regretting their choice to go to med school, but they just didn't know. They came from their first generation students over here. All their parents knew was like, oh, you're either going to be an engineer, a lawyer, or a doctor. And they didn't know what being a doctor consisted of, and now they're kind of biting the bullet, like, they're in their fourth year saying, oh, I wish I would have pick something else. They said if I knew what I knew now, I definitely wouldn't have gone into this. I'm going to tell my siblings, don't go. Like, if you want to go into medicine, don't choose the MD route. And again, these are just their personal experiences. There's some people who love what they do and say, I wouldn't change it for the world.
Yeah, and vice versa.
Think those people, yeah.
Like, if you're a PA.
Yeah, I think those people knew what they were getting into before. I'm grateful that my friend's dad, Dr. Bass, who I don't know if he still works at Hopkins, he was the one who gave me the opportunity to figure out what I wanted to do in medicine. He gave me, like, during my little internship with him, I shadowed a surgeon, an NP, a PA, internal medicine docs. I did inpatient. I did outpatient. Perfusionists. I went around with the respiratory team. I did
any,
RN.
Any so, pre-PA students, this is what you have to put in your personal CV. So listen,
yeah,
close. This is,
yeah, so you know exactly what you're getting into, because there's so many other professions in medicine, and I think we're just, for the most part, the general population only knows doctors and nurses, and kind of like the whole NP and PA are just becoming a little bit more prevalent in our generation. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for those who are out there listening, please, the pre-PA students, make sure you have done your research and you know the different options that are available to you, and don't just limit yourself to whether you were making the decision between getting an MD or being a PA or RN. There's so many other professions out there, or NP, yep.
Yeah, and I would say vice versa. If you, like, you know, want to be a P, you know you want to be the one to make the shots, make the calls, or, like, you want to make sure you know the full breadth of whatever medicine you go into, then it sounds like maybe, you know, becoming a doctor, whether it's MD or DO, might be a better choice for you. And, you know, I know as PAs, we want to be more autonomous, and we should, but we're still working on that. And I would say even for myself, you know, working with underserved patients that are socially and medically complex, sometimes I'm like, I wish I had a little bit more medical background. So I don't know, I think maybe a doctoral degree might be a good option in the long term, to help me gain more confidence with that, in addition to just, like, you know, studying on my own. But I do like being able to apply my knowledge now and use that critical thinking skill when making, you know, clinical judgment decisions when working with patients, which, again, I know that's the purpose of a residency, but I can't afford to be a resident either. But I think maybe not a requirement to become a PA right now. That's my, if you were to ask me, that's my take on it.
Good, good. Well, thank you everyone for listening to this month's podcast and joining us today.
Yes. And please be sure that you're following JAAP on social media. Their Instagram handle is at JAAPA online. And under October's issue posts, let us know your thoughts about the topics we went over today. We'd love to hear your input.
We look forward to November's podcast. Thank you and see you soon.
See you soon.